Hello and welcome to Physics Frontiers. This is episode number 40, Octonions. Show notes, including links to the papers we read for this podcast, can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/40. Hey Randy, how's it going?
Jim, it's good to hear from you.
Randy, what would you like to talk about today?
Well, I found this wonderful article about Cole Fury doing work on octonions in a Quantum Magazine article recently. And I was really impressed by the work that she's doing. It's very high-level stuff, but I'm kind of fascinated by what she's finding, and I'd love to talk about it. She's done a lot of work on this theory in recent years, and it looks like it's a promising way of approaching the problem of a unified field theory and predicting the entire standard model from basic mathematical principles.
Okay, so could you tell me what you think an octonion is?
Well, you've got four sets of normed division algebras, the real numbers, the complex numbers, the quaternions, and then the octonions. And the real number system is a one-dimensional system, the complex number is a two-dimensional system, the quaternions is a four-dimensional system, and the octonions is an eight-dimensional system. The weird thing is that they have totally different kinds of mathematical logic. And so as you go up with each level, the algebra gets more and more complicated. It's really hard to follow. I've been reading a lot of stuff about it. John Baez has a good PDF about octonions, but even the PDF is really extremely high level. So I don't think that I could do any of the kind of derivations that she's doing, but fortunately she sums up her results in her papers, so we don't have to. What did you want to say about octonions?
What would I like to say about octonions? Well, I'm not sure that there's a lot really to say about octonions. I mean, they're a simple mathematical object. They look difficult, but I think the difficulty with the octonions is the way in which they're used in physics. I don't think, as far as an actual mathematical object, they're that difficult. They're mostly just a eight-dimensional vector with some interesting rules here and there for how unit vectors, how directions multiply together. So I think the way to look at this is sort of look at the quaternions first, right? The quaternions are sort of a four-dimensional vector or a four-dimensional complex number in a way. So they've got four entries, you've got four different directions. You could call them E0, E1, E2, and E3. But normally you just call E0, 1, so you sort of ignore that that has a direction. And you call the other three I, J, and K. So if you've taken first-year physics in the U.S., for example, almost every first-year textbook uses, for I, J, and K, the X, Y, and Z direction. And that's exactly what the quaternions do. You have these X, Y, and Z directions plus a fourth direction, and you can use your imagination to guess what that is. Yeah, I mean, especially considering that the way it transforms is a little bit different from the way these other three transform.
Right, and so it's the perfect formula for special relativity.
And so it has some relationship to special relativity. It's very, very similar to a four-vector in special relativity. It's different than your normal four-vector, but you can do all the mathematics with it. It's not very difficult. In fact, the way people use the quaternions to build up special relativity is very interesting. When she's talking about doing special relativity with the quaternions, which is one of three things I think she does with the quaternions, she's talking about it as being the algebra of propagators, the algebra of different ways you can get from one point in space-time, or one event in space-time, as you usually call it, to another event in space-time. And basically, every time you have a multiplication, when you multiply one of these quaternions by another one, and another one, and another one, then you have a path that goes from one place to another place to another place. When you add, you have two world lines joining, basically. So that's basically how they work for special relativity. It's a very interesting way to look at things, and it's related to causal sets, which are sort of similar to, but not really the same thing as the consistent histories things we were talking about a few months ago.
Yeah, I did notice that there's a lot of set theory and group theory and all that kind of stuff, and I have a little trouble with this kind of work because it's such high level, like such abstract mathematics. You know, you've got Clifford algebras and Jordan algebras, and it's hard to visualize. I like to be able to get my head around something and see a scenario in my mind and see, oh, okay, if this is on this trajectory exposed to this field, then it's going to do this thing. And all of this really high-level math stuff is so abstract that it's hard to see it, you know?
Well, yeah, and a lot of the other things that people are doing in this, and I should have said that I think that stuff with special relativity is stuff that Fury took from other people. I'm not sure exactly how much she's added to it. A lot of this stuff is like that. She's added some things here, some things there. But the stuff that seems to be most interesting to her and to a lot of these people is to try to use these Octonions and the Quaternions to categorize particles and make a categorization scheme for the standard model that has a little more mathematical basis than the choice that's been made for the SU3 cross SU2 cross O1/Z6 model.
It looks to me, and I guess I should probably mention the papers. We're looking at a couple of her papers. She has one called Towards a Unified Theory of Ideals. That was published in Physical Review D in 2012. And then this year, just this month, actually, in October, she published Three Generations, Two Unbroken Gauge Symmetries, and One Eight-Dimensional Algebra in Physics Letters B. Plus, she has a thesis, and she has a YouTube channel, which I discovered right before we started recording tonight.
So she has 14 short episodes on YouTube. I'm not sure if it ends up being an hour or if it ends up being half an hour. It's not really very long watching through all of those things. And she basically just goes over, I think, her thesis. If you go through those, it's basically what her dissertation was. So she goes through most of that stuff in there. So you did get through the Physics Letters B thing that I sent you. You did actually read that.
Yes, I feel a little bad because that one's still behind a paywall, and normally we only do articles that are available freely online, but it was so relevant and contemporary to what we're going to talk about that it seemed like a good idea to read it so we can talk about it at least.
Sure it's behind a paywall? I thought it was a free article.
Well, I saw that it was a Springer link, and so I assumed that it's paywalled.
I was under the impression when I downloaded it was free, because I downloaded it from home, and I don't automatically connect to the school's servers that way. So, I mean, I just went there, and I'm going to have to figure out how to get access to this, and, you know, it just said, no, you can read it if you want to. I said, oh, okay, then I will.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, good.
Although I didn't. From what I did when I looked through this, I think this is mostly stuff that was in her thesis, was chapter 9 of her thesis. So I think I've read most of it. And it includes the one page in the 94 pages that for some reason was left blank by the printer. So that was nice to see all of the things that I'd missed.
I think she might have developed a little bit further because in her thesis, she was like, I'm just making the first steps towards producing the three generations of quarks and leptons. And in this paper, and you're right, it is free on, is it ELSVA? I'm not sure how to pronounce that. And in this paper, she's, you know, got it pretty well worked out, and you can actually see all the equations that produces, like, all of the quarks and neutrinos and electron generations. I guess that's electron, muon, and tau. I'm getting the impression, I mean, from reading all of her stuff, that she's looking at basically creating, how can I put this? She seems to be saying that by analyzing just the pure mathematics, how this algebra acts on itself, that all of these fundamental particles and fields and interactions falls out of it naturally, which is fascinating because, I mean, you don't usually think of electrical charge and things like that as operators, as just pure mathematical objects like that, and that she seems to be describing it that way. So it's almost like she's describing reality as the embodiment of a system of mathematics in its purest form.
That is a little bit of what I get, especially from hearing her talk. You know, I don't know how she views the reality of mathematics and stuff like that. I mean, I look at these things and I look at a more compact categorization scheme than just the symmetry groups that you normally see in the standard model. For example, when she's talking about using the number operator as the electric charge, right? Well, to me, that number operator means nothing. Yeah, you have one level, two level, three level. You have level zero, which is your neutrino. And then you move up, you go to the up quarks, the down quarks, and the positron. That is your energy level zero, or I guess it's not your level zero, level one, level two, level three. Levels 2 and 3 have eigenvalue degeneracies of 3, which makes them look a lot like quarks. And so you have something here with this number operator, with this that you get from your raising and lowering operators, these numbers. So eigenvalue 0, eigenvalue 1, eigenvalue 2, eigenvalue 3. You divide that by 3, you end up with the charge for those 4 different objects. That's interesting. I don't see any reason to believe that that's the fundamental reason for electric charge. it seems to me to be devoid of physical content, right? You're just saying we've got this operator, it goes up and it goes down, and I can say that this is an up quark. I can say that this is a down quark. But there's no reason for anybody to believe that it necessarily is. You just are finding a way using the octonions to categorize these things that you see in the real world. And it's interesting, but I'm not really sure that it has any physical meaning.
I mean, I think these are preliminary steps, but I think what she's hoping to achieve is that by taking like the four normed division algebras and taking the tensor product of all of them, that she could reproduce the entire standard model and gravity and electrical fields and everything. I think what she's aiming for, like a new kind of unified field theory where all of reality is basically governed by a series of algebraic relationships and rules.
Well, yeah, and I think that's exactly what people have been doing with the octonion since, what, 1974, maybe earlier. And even the R cross C cross H cross O algebra, I mean, that was investigated by a guy by the name of Dixon previously. She's got some really clever things, like that number operator, and she's done some other things with it that make it a lot smoother, make it look a lot cleaner and much more likely to be true. But, you know, it just seems to be a categorization scheme. I don't see where there's physics here. That's my issue.
Yeah, it's definitely like such a different approach that it's hard to see how it describes real world situations. But if she can create like a palette of all the different properties, including like spin and chirality and isospin and color and all this kind of stuff, I think it might be possible that she might be able to find like the underlying mathematical edifice which would predict all of the physics that we see. Because if these properties are coming out of the mathematics naturally just through the rules of logic, then maybe what we're seeing is a model where reality is more mathematical than physical. I mean, you know, that's what it seems like. I've normally been revolted by the idea of like math being this absolute thing and physics being a secondary product of that. But in this case, it seems like she's making some serious progress in that direction.
And I actually like it better than when I'm reading about the standard model or something like that. But it's still like anything where you just look at abstract stuff, you have to bring it back to the physics somewhere. So it seems to me that you complete something like this, it's not really the end. It's sort of a beginning. It's or maybe even a helpful tool to help you figure out what sort of physics actually does this. Just because you can reproduce something mathematically doesn't mean it actually has anything to do with the real world. So, you know, these things are quite interesting when you pull these out and you look at these different quarks and look at the basis vectors that are associated with them. But what does that really mean? And why would some of these things actually exist? For example, why would taking a W plus and a W minus, multiplying them together, why would that give you a neutrino?
I was hoping that you might be able to answer questions like that because I don't understand the rules of the mathematics that she's implying here well enough to make the direct connection to physical reality. You know, I guess I assumed that it seems like an intuitive description to her, you know. But for me, I don't see directly that connection, and I'm not sure if she's actually going to be able to generate all that kind of modeling. But I did notice some weird indications, like there's a statement in here where she talks about, let's see here, towards a unified theory of ideals. And she says that these operators can maybe give us a new insight on the description of mass. And I was like, wait, how do those relate to mass? So I'm wondering if in a hypothetical scenario where she was able to reproduce the entire standard model using this mathematical approach, I think what she's saying is that the masses should just fall right out of that.
Well, I don't see how you do that. I mean, you might have to, I guess you have to somehow describe the mass in terms of those directions or something like that. I have no idea how that would actually work.
Yeah, me either. But I think that's what she's going for. Like, she's going for like a mathematical model that completely predicts like all the standard particles and interactions and masses and charges and everything. She's even got, what was it, a rudimentary model of the electroweak force?
Well, that comes out earlier on, I think. But she does have something where she can sort of predict the hypercharge, I think.
Yeah, so there's these fascinating glimmers. I mean, it kind of reminds me of like the successes, although superstring theory has only had a few of these, like the alarming successes that you'd run into like when it would make predictions about like black hole dynamics or something. She seems to be touching on like any number of chunks of modern physics and modeling them with this system. And I'm really intrigued by it.
Okay, so where do we go from there?
Oh my gosh. I don't know about you. Do they teach, like, is this a PhD level kind of math? Because there's a lot of stuff in here that went right over my head. I tried to get my head around it. I just couldn't. Octaonic automorphisms, you know, what the heck is that?
A lot of those terms are things that you'd get in any old abstract algebra classes in undergraduate. That if you're a physicist, you're probably not taking. So that's something you probably have to pick up in graduate school. I mean, they're just ways that different things relate to each other. If you don't know what they are, you have to look them up and figure out what they mean. They're names for different relationships between things. What are the actual issues that you're having with the math?
Oh, I don't know. It's hard to see how all these different like group theory systems are working together in order to produce relationships where she's seeing internal degrees of freedom in the algebra, such as the color and the weak iso spin and the charge and chirality and the spin and all that kind of stuff. It's hard to understand. Is she talking about just transformations of the geometry that have the necessary properties to conform to the equations that describe these features of physics?
Well, I'm not sure if they have anything to do with the real geometry of anything, the physical geometry. They have a lot to do with how the mathematics works.
Yeah, like the subspaces of the math.
Yeah, but, you know, I don't think she's saying when she's talking about rotating up quarks 120 degrees to turn them from, you know, red to green. I don't think she's saying she can turn an up quark from red to green. She's just saying that it performs some of these operations, can look at a different object. All these objects, yes, she's saying they're ideals, but they're eigenvalues, basically, of the mathematical operator or the mathematical multiplication that's associated with the algebra for the octonions. They're associated with the algebra that she's using for the octonions. There might be a slightly different algebra available for them. I'm not completely sure. So I was pretty sure what was going on with all of these things. I had quickly programmed all of these in. But even doing all of that, that doesn't necessarily mean I've got a really good handle on some of these higher level things that Fury does.
Yeah, I remember she did say that you could get all of the antiparticles as the whole entire set of those, all three generations of those, just by taking the complex conjugate, right?
Yeah, so she takes a complex conjugate of all those things on the upper half of that diagram that she was drawing. So she takes these three generations for matter and takes a complex conjugate. She gets three generations of antimatter, basically. That plus the generators fills out the eigenvalues for this 16 by 16 set, which has a name or something that I've forgotten.
Can this system predict the range of forces and things like that, like where you could really look at physical scenarios?
What she's doing does not seem to do that, but like I think you've said, especially like it implies in the popular article you sent me, I think she wants to do stuff like that, that she's not doing that right now. She's still just trying to fit everything in, right?
She's finding all the particles and seeing if she could find all the properties and all that stuff, right?
And so it looks like she's got the leptons and the quarks.
That's fantastic, you know.
She doesn't really have the forces.
Oh, I see. So that would be a next step.
But somewhere in here, she was saying that the W plus and the W minus are closely related to the neutrino. So I'm not really sure how that works. I mean, that was thrown out there sort of mathematically. I don't really know what the physical reason for that is. You know, I was supposed to come back this afternoon after my coffee and reading all this stuff and actually try to look up some reactions to see if that made any sense. And I've tried a little bit, but I don't see those reactions in anything that I see. I don't have really the kind of library at home to be sure that that makes sense. But I just don't see anything where that multiplication makes a lot of sense. It might not really mean anything, right? Because I don't really know what the multiplication means in this octonion sector. I don't know what the multiplication means. I only know what the multiplication really, really, really means in that Lorentz gauge thing that she's talking about. I understand what she's talking about, what the multiplication means there. I don't really understand what the multiplication means in this case. I mean, what it physically means, what it corresponds to as far as a physical anything.
If she's getting like electrical charge out of these operators, does that imply the field qualities of an electrical field?
I don't think so. I think especially since the C cross H for the quaternions, she can get the electromagnetic field or somebody previous. So especially with the C cross H stuff, I'm not sure how much is her and how much is other people. With the C cross O stuff, I think it's almost all what she was doing, but I think there's quite a bit in the C cross H that she got from other people. So yeah, I don't think you see anything that has anything to do with the bosons in this particular system as yet. It may be there, but I don't think she's advertising it as being there.
Is that because she's focusing on these like left-handed operations?
There was something about what's going on with the right-handed operations. I don't think that she thinks, at least in what I've read, that the right-handed operations become...
the even spin particles? Maybe that self-annihilates and so it doesn't even describe any particles or anything?
Yeah, I don't think she's saying anything about that.
It was startling to see that the special unitary groups just like fall right out of this system. It makes you feel like you're kind of getting a peek at like the underlying logic of reality when... you know, when that comes out, like if that just naturally falls out of just doing math, it seems to me like haven't we like basically invented these different types of mathematical structures in order to describe what we found empirically? And now it seems like she's taking it from the other direction to see if number theory can just automatically predict all these structures. So Dixon comes up several times because he did a lot of that work on the complexified quaternions, but he also worked on octonions too, right?
Dixon, I think, is the person who came up with the C cross H cross O, which is exactly the same as the R cross C cross H cross O, but it's more fun to put the R in there explicitly.
So you can see all four different sets of number theory?
Well, yeah, so you can see all four of the division algebras, because they're all at work in this thing. So, yeah, Dixon did a lot of previous work on this particular system.
And also a couple names that came up with were Gnaden and Gerzy. I don't know who those are. Have you heard of them before?
I hadn't heard of them before. I think they're the people who really started looking at the octonions for particle physics in the 70s, in 1974. I think they're the ones who first figured out how to do stuff with quarks with the octonions.
That's interesting. So that might be good for further research.
I mean, have you gone through the reference list at the end of her thesis?
No, I only looked at like her papers in her references because I was just trying to get caught up with what she was doing.
Let me see if I can find that list I made. We've got awesome things like she's got a reference to somebody's paper, Anastasio, A Magic Pyramid of Supergravities. That's a pretty good one.
That sounds great.
She's got about four or five references to different people doing stuff on causal sets, like her doctoral advisor, Lee Smolin. The universe as a process of unique events, quantum energetic causal sets. Causal sets and the deep structure of space-time. So causal sets would be another cool one to do. A good one on particle models and non-commutative geometry. I'd want to look at that. I've read a couple of that guy's papers. Dixon has a paper called Seeable Matter, Unseeable Antimatter. That would probably be a fun one to look at. I don't know what it is, so it might not be. Volumes of space as subsystems. Building up space-time from quantum entanglement.
Oh, yeah. She mentioned that in one of the papers, I remember.
Geometry from quantum particles.
I think it was maybe in her thesis where she was questioning whether space-time needed to be considered as like a fundamental characteristic of reality. Maybe particles just exist on their own and we just interpret space-time as physical.
I think that's a big thing. I think that was going around with that sort of process stuff and with the causal sets. So I think those causal sets are something I'd really like to look at some point in the future. As well as I'd like to look at some of these fourth generation models that apparently got ruled out by the Higgs boson.
Oh.
So a lot of the extensions of the standard model that have a fourth generation of quarks and leptons, they apparently are not viable with a 126 gigaelectron volt Higgs particle.
Yeah, right. So it does look like there's like a fundamental like reality to the three generations, right?
Well, I don't know, because she also has two references to people saying that these are some other things that would actually work with that. So a lot of models got pushed aside, but there's still a couple that possibly could work. So we'd have to look at that to actually get an idea about how strong that result is for this particular implication. Although we could just read the titles of the papers and pretend we know everything.
No thanks. That's okay. There's definitely way more to know than any brain can process, I think. One of the statements that caught my eye in her dissertation, her thesis,
it's a dissertation. Just because I keep calling it a thesis doesn't mean it's not a dissertation.
Was that she said, here we argue that physical concepts such as particles, causality, and irreversible time may result from the algebra acting on itself.
Yeah, I think that's still the thing that I was talking about, where she was saying that the C cross H has this representation where you're saying that when you're taking one quaternion and having it act on the last quaternion, you're saying this is a process that goes from one event to another event in space-time. And the only things that really exist are the processes that take you from one place to another, or combine the two processes, or combine the results of two processes. So what does that actually mean? What actually happens in some idea like that? And I'm actually partial to that kind of idea. It makes quite a lot of sense to me until I think about it too much. But I really like the idea that the only thing that's happening are things that are happening. It's a very Whiteheadian sort of idea.
Was Whiteheadian really into like these models where the mathematical machinery is the reality?
Yeah, Alfred North Whitehead, his philosophy was process philosophy. Well, his big philosophy. When he's a mathematician, but he had this big process philosophy idea, which is about the world sort of evolving at the current state from the last state in some sort of way through all these local processes and ignoring all the individual things that happen in between the events. So it's really just about the process and the unfolding of time, basically, the unfolding of the universe.
How did he feel about quantum physics, where particles were in an indeterminate state between points A and B? That would kind of fit with what he's saying, right?
I think that's part of the thing that he's saying. That is really nasty philosophy. That's the kind of philosophy that is very precise and very abstract. Process philosophy is not easy stuff to get your head around. So as much as I'd love to sit around and talk about process and reality with you for an hour, I can't really do it without trying to go through that book again, which I'm probably never going to try to do.
Fair enough. I feel like I need like 3 or 4 years of math and number theory and maybe process philosophy too, to really get a good appreciation of what she's doing with her work here, because it's a very alien way of looking at physics. You know, it's such a pure math way of looking at physics that it's kind of hard to intuitively understand, you know?
Well, yeah, but I always get that same feeling when I'm looking at, you know, just standard model stuff. I always have this feeling that, you know, I'm looking at something that's not completely grounded. And I always feel a little bit bad about that because, you know, these guys know so much more than me about what they're doing that maybe there's something out there that really is grounding it. But I don't see that as much as they do. I don't know if that means anything.
No, I know what you mean. That's why I had to take on, and I'm taking on faith while I'm reading through these papers, that there may be embedded levels of logic in these mathematical arguments that connect to reality in a way that I'm just not seeing, because I'm not used to thinking of reality in such abstract terms as, you know, these different kinds of just mathematical relationships, you know?
Yeah. You know, it makes some sense as long as you're playing around with these things to say, okay, if I know that I have these sorts of symmetries, this is the sort of structure that the world has to have. Or if I find this sort of structure, that means I have these symmetries. And then, you know, these are some other things I can talk about. That's a level that's perfectly good. Now, obviously, if she can go through and she can reconstruct the entire standard model this way, then she can start making predictions. And then we start to get some interplay between reality and the mathematics, right? And then things turn into a really the standard sort of scientific give and take. But where she's at now, as far as I can tell, she's not at the point where she has the scientific give and take between experiment and mathematics.
It does blow my mind that she's able to go this far, though, on just pure number theory without putting any kind of numerical inputs into any of this stuff.
But she's dealing mostly with the symmetry. So she's dealing with these symmetries. She's dealing with this set of numbers. And she's trying to find in these sets of numbers operators and things that fit the symmetries. And when you're listening to her talk, it's like listening to a mathematician talk. Like, let's define this as this, right? Well, fine. You can define that as 1 minus ik over 2. That's a great thing to define something as. But a lot of times it doesn't seem to me that there's any physical reason to say that this has to be that, other than you want this result in the end. And that's fine at the point where not just she, but the other people that are working on these octonions. It's clear from Baez's paper that there are quite a few people working in a similar vein with the octonions and other abstract mathematical structures. You know, that's not where science is strong. Categorizing stuff through definitions is not where science is strong. Science is strong when there's an immediate interplay between experiment and mathematics, where there's a way you can say, okay, this is the reason why 1 minus IE7 over 2 is the neutrino or whatever it is. I probably got that.
Well, no, that exact term comes up in this diagram of the eigenvectors of the weak Isis spin operator. And she's got the three different colors of up and down quarks and the neutrino and the electron right there.
Yeah, the thing that I said was actually the positron. But the only reason why I said 1 minus IE7 was I knew that it was either the positron or the neutrino because I was playing around with this earlier. But why is it a positron? What makes it a positron? You know, that might not seem completely fair, but in a way it is. If this E7 doesn't have a physical meaning, then, you know, it's just a categorization scheme. I'd like to know why it's a positron, and I'd like to know why it might be that I'd like to know stuff like that. You know, it's nice that, you know, she's looking at these ideals of the octonions and saying that, you know, we're always going back into the same set and stuff like that. But I'd really like to know where the physical content of a statement like that is.
Yeah, you'd always like to see some assignment of values to some of these numbers so that you could calculate things like charge and mass. I guess she's getting charge off of here.
She's getting charge from the eigenvalues. So she's saying that if I multiply this neutrino thing by this other thing, I get zero times this other thing or something like that. That means that the eigenvalue for that neutrino thing is zero.
Shouldn't there be some way, for example, to find like the three different flavors of neutrinos with a system like this?
She has those. That's in that later paper, in the one that just came out. That's when she was talking about those 32.
Oh, okay, the three generations. So she's got the three generations of neutrinos, and she's got the electron, the muon, and the tau.
So those are all there. Those are all there.
Fantastic.
With those definitions. But again, when I'm looking at these fairly simple linear combinations of unit vectors, I don't really understand what those unit vectors mean. So if I don't understand what those unit vectors mean, I don't really understand what they mean about the electron or the muon. I don't know what they mean about the electron. I don't know what they mean about the neutrino. I don't know what they mean about anything. So if I don't know what they mean, then I don't know what it means to have them in this symmetry classification, other than you can classify the quarks and the leptons together in this way with the octonions.
Well, maybe if she could get the Higgs boson out of this system, then maybe she could begin seeing if she could predict the rest masses of these particles, so we could bring it home to get some solid experimental predictions out of it.
Yeah, that would be a little bit scarier in some way here. And the reason why I'd say that is, you know, the number operator is actually a fairly simple thing, right? I mean, that it came out the way she wanted is pretty amazing. She may have taken a lot of time finding the raising and lowering operators to make that work, but she's found these operators that will do something like that. And again, that's pretty amazing. But when you get to the masses don't look like things that this will be able to predict easily. The masses aren't in nice little chunks, and I don't think they look like a linear combination of eight different values. So, I mean, they may be, but they just look like they're out in the middle of nowhere in some way. They probably don't have to be, but when you get into other things, the more stuff you add, the harder and harder it is to make everything work. Maybe she can do it, but it's just harder and harder and messier, and pretty soon you lose the simplicity that makes it compelling. It really is the simplicity here that makes this description compelling. It's not the octonions themselves. You know, they're just even more useless numbers that are an extension of some useless numbers, you know, the quaternions. You know, you remember Mike, maybe it was when I was reading the History of Vectors book or something like that. But, you know, I talked to Mike, and then you remember Mike came back and he'd done some reading up on it because he's a mathematician. And he said, yeah, all these are good for saving you CPU cycles. That's the only real application. A lot of these things show up all over the place in mathematics. I mean, if you were reading the octonions paper, it's just amazing how many strange places the octonions show up. But the more strange places they show up, the more it looks like a coincidence when somebody's able to find something interesting.
She did make a compelling argument, though. I only caught the first segment of her YouTube channel where she was pointing out that once we discovered the complex number system, then we had the tools for developing quantum theory. And then once we had the quaternions, we had the tools for understanding Lorentz transformations and special relativity. And that she thinks, you know, it makes sense that this other algebra, this other number system, should also have a deep fundamental relationship to physics.
I mean, the interesting part about the history is that once you have the complex numbers, you're all of a sudden got a two-dimensional vector that you can use. And that makes the ideas of physics in multiple dimensions more compelling and something you can actually do. And that's actually why Hamilton invented the quaternions, is he was trying to find a three-dimensional number system, which sort of failed. And that's why, you know, when Gibbs and Heaviside, I think, went on and invented vectors, everybody just forgot about the quaternions. And then after that, you didn't really need these fancy and esoteric number systems to deal with everything. You could actually use something that looked a little more physical, that seemed to better reflect what was going on in your theory, which is the vectors. You can make vectors reflect what's going on in your theory very, very well. Whereas the quaternions, you had weird things wandering around. Special relativity itself seems very, very happy with normal everyday tensor algebra. It doesn't feel like you really need the quaternions for it.
But isn't it more elegantly expressed in terms of quaternions?
It looks almost exactly the same. I mean, really, if you're using unit vector notation, it looks almost exactly the same. The interesting thing is the way you're able to look at the quaternions as sort of these propagators. But that you probably could do with vectors as well. It just doesn't feel as nice when you do it. I don't think there's anything special about the quaternions there. I could be absolutely wrong. And obviously, if you know better, you know, there are some comments and you can tell me exactly why.
No, all I did is notice that John Baez was writing about it, and he seemed to be pretty excited about how the quaternions related to the Lorentz transformations.
Well, I mean, it's kind of interesting the way it works. I think the problem is you know, it ends up being a double cover of the rotations. That sort of annoys me a little bit. I mean, it's the reason why you have in quantum mechanics these weird effects like rotating your coordinate system by 360 degrees and the spins all flipping over, which I've never really understood, but it still shows up in undergraduate texts. Yeah, I mean, it is interesting that the spinners show up so readily in this, but if they didn't, probably we wouldn't be talking about it now. Right?
Fair enough. I'm going to have to spend some more time reading up on this. I think it's pretty fascinating. I've never really been as mesmerized by the abstract mathematics behind theoretical physics until I saw what she was trying to do with it and had succeeded in doing structurally with the standard model. And she's got an amazing name, Cole Fury. And she's got that like Romulan haircut. In the article, it mentioned that if she didn't get a job in academia, that she was going to play the accordion in New Orleans and busk for money to support her physics habit. I mean, how could you not love her?
Yeah, I wasn't going to bring that up. I have thought the reason why you wanted to talk about this is because of that line.
Well, I mean, it would have been great to like run into her busking on the street and find out that she's, you know, a genius at abstract algebras and looking for the secrets of the universe. I mean, you get the impression that she's looking for like some kind of underlying mathematical edifice that like dictates all of reality. You know, it's a really cool ambition.
This is something that people with that sort of mathematical outlook often try to do. I mean, it sounds like she's got some pretty deep thoughts, and certainly if she ends up in New Orleans, she should look you up. You can sit out on the rooftops with the gargoyles and talk about physics.
I think I'm going to have a lot of studying to do before I could talk about it at her level, though. Holy cow. She's done work with the Perimeter Institute and MIT, and now she's at Cambridge. So, yeah, she's doing some amazing work with some amazing people.
So I would like to go over in her dissertation. She did talk about some conceptual problems with the standard model.
Oh, okay. I must have missed that part. So what caught your eye?
Well, what I would like to know is I would like to get from you is, do you think she's gotten around these limitations? So she says that one of the problems with the standard model is it singles out this SU3, SU2, U1/Z6 symmetry. But it doesn't say where it comes from. Do you think, one, that, you know, this does say where that comes from? And I guess, two, if so, does it say where the octonions come from? So, I mean, it seems to me that if she has a physical reason for using the octonions, she does find a way to get to that SU3, SU2, U1/Z6, less Z6 symmetry. But it doesn't look to me like she has any physical reason for using the octonions.
Physically, no, but I can see where conceptually that she'd want to go there. because there's only the four norm division algebras to start with, right? And all of the other ones have been exfoliated as, you know, physically significant. And so it would make sense to look at the next group and see what it might have to say. And, you know, since there's only four to work with, then if there's going to be some kind of hidden symmetries to be found, that seems like the right place to look, right? And I think it seems justified that she's able to come up with the 64-dimensional structure required to find, like, all three generations of quarks and leptons using it. So logically, it seems like it's well-motivated, but physically, I guess I don't know how to really answer that question. I think you see that symmetry in the standard model, and then she's able to find it in this mathematical edifice. I mean, seems like a pretty amazing coincidence if she just happened to achieve that, you know, using nothing but the rules of logic and math. How do you feel about it?
I think I already said I don't think there's any physical justification for using the Actonians.
Yeah, I don't think physical justification, but holy crap, I mean, as a mathematician, I can see why you'd want to go after it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's why that popular article sort of referred to it as numerology. Let's see. The second conceptual problem with the standard model is that it specifies a list of particle representations. You know, what counts as a particle in the standard model does not explain why those particular representations are preferred. You think you have a good idea about why each one of the particles in these octonions are those particular particles?
No. Her reasoning there goes over my head, but I just assume that people with more expertise in the field might get it more than I do.
Yeah, it seems to me that they are eigenvalues of the multiplication operator, and so that makes some sort of sense that they'd be a real thing. So probably that's, at least mathematically, that's satisfied, because basically what you'd like for a particle is that if you're in one of these things where you've got a propagator going along, you'd like your thing to be the same thing at the beginning and at the end of the process. Again, since I don't really understand what the Actonian part, I don't understand what the Actonian multiplication means physically. It makes it a little bit harder to understand what the eigenvalue means physically.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
So I feel a little more comfortable with why she chose those particular particle representations. Still doesn't help me understand what they're supposed to be. One of the things going on here is that even in the standard model, the SU2L symmetry acts only on left-handed spinners, but not right-handed ones. Do you see any reason here for the reason why nothing's happening with the right-handed ones?
No, I don't understand that at all. Can you explain it?
Can I explain it? There's apparently something going on with the minimal ideals. I don't understand exactly why, but apparently the minimal ideals aren't working out for the right-handed spinners.
I assume there's a kind of mathematical reason for that, right?
Yes, but it's one of these things that I'm not completely sure about. I think she's saying that if something was a little bit different, maybe it would work out, but it doesn't seem to.
Does that have something to do with the Fano plane and how the multiplication rules work on octonions, do you think?
No, that is not what it was talking about. It went into more complicated Clifford algebras, but apparently the issue had something to do with the minimal ideals. That's what I'm remembering right now. And how about the last conceptual problem with the standard model was the ad hoc arrangement of hypercharges. How do you feel about hypercharges? Do you understand how she gets the different hypercharges for the different particles?
No. How does she do that?
She does that with the eigenvalues. Actually, I think she actually gets those things out of the mathematics.
But they are ad hoc in the standard model, right? I mean, we basically seem to be discovering this stuff first and then writing the math about it later.
Yeah, it does seem ad hoc in the standard model. Like she's saying, that's the issue that she has with it. So that's pretty much what I have. I just thought when she mentioned those, I mean, I think it was like in chapter 5, sort of after she went through C cross H in her thesis, she was talking about, you know, the conceptual problems with the standard model that she was going to try to build up. And she lists these out, and I wrote them down mainly because I was interested to see, one, if she specifically addressed these later on. And I don't think she specifically addressed them. I mean, I think she addressed a lot of the issues, but I don't think she specifically addressed them as against the problems with the standard model. And, you know, she definitely didn't, in her conclusion, list them or something like that. Like, if I made a list like this, I'd here are some problems with the other guys. At the end, I'd probably want to put how my solution, if I haven't solved that problem, I'd at least want to say, oh, it's working towards that solution. So we didn't talk about some of the other interesting things. That's fine, because most of the really, really interesting things here are really, really technical. sort of like she's a little bit agnostic about some, I guess there are some things that we didn't talk about that are interesting. Like she's agnostic about whether or not the neutrinos are their own antiparticle or not. So that has something to do with what happens with the thing that she's calling a vacuum state, which isn't necessarily a vacuum state because, well, it's a neutrino. The neutrino is what her scare quotes vacuum state is in that C cross H stuff. We didn't talk about how she gets the surviving unbroken symmetries like the U1 electromagnetic symmetry. So the standard model symmetries are really the high energy symmetries before the symmetries break down. The ones we actually have in the real world are just the SU3 and the U1 electromagnetic rather than the U1 hypercharge symmetry. But I think that's all I've got for this. Do you have any other interesting things to talk about? What do you know about the instanton solution of the Yang-Mills in 8 dimensions?
Oh, she covered that in her thesis. I must have.
No. That was in John Baez's.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I just picked around in that. I didn't really read the whole thing. It was like 56 pages long or something.
Well, when I sent you that link, I didn't think you were going to try to read that paper. That link at the bottom of it had a bunch of links to, you know, smaller, more digestible information. Well, reading the thesis and that paper over the weekend, that's been pretty heavy for me, at least.
Yeah, it's a lot of high-level math and a lot of abstract thinking. I'd never even seen the Fano plane or the octonions before. So I was like, what is this stuff? Like, it's non-associative and non-commutative? Like, okay.
Yeah, well, with Fano, I don't know. I mean, I remember that Fano wrote Physics of Atoms and Molecules book, so it makes it hard for me to figure out if I actually heard about the Fano plane previously or not. Because once you know somebody's name, it's hard to figure out if anything associated with it is something you've heard of before. That Fano structure is an interesting mnemonic device. So if you want to actually do the calculations yourself by hand, it's useful to have around. But like I said, it takes about an hour and a half to program all of these rules into your computer.
Is that what you did? You programmed this stuff into your computer?
Yeah.
Wow.
So they're not really complicated mathematical artifices. It's the interpretation that's complicated. But, you know, the problem with them is that you have 8 different directions, and when you multiply directions together, you get another direction, and you have to figure out whether it's another direction. Multiplication gives you a positive or a negative contribution to it, and stuff like that. So you use this Fano plane to let you do that. But if you're programming, you just program in the entire stupid times table for these directions. Whatever program you make, you can probably do any of the silly sets that you looked at when you took your abstract algebra course as a junior. You can use those. You can just program those in, and you can have all of those groups in the same system. I mean, the way I did it, you can put any of those groups together and be fine. In fact, you could do any of the ones when I was reading the magnetic symmetries book last year. You can do any of those weird, really complicated condensed matter symmetries in that same way. Because in the end, they just end up being, you know, a multiplication table, because that's what a group is. And remember, of course, every time we've thought, oh, particle physics is really, really complicated and difficult, all this math is, let's go look at some condensed matter theory, then you learn how complicated and messy math really gets. Although maybe you've forgotten about that because we've just stayed away from it since those papers.
Thank God.
You know, the mathematical structure just really isn't that difficult. The only thing is that if you're trying to do all these things by hand, then you kind of have to get this thing going. But if you're doing all these things by hand, you're going to get a really good idea about this one system, about what's going on. You know, the thing I did that gives me a great idea about the superstructure, but it was actually too easy. It was a lot easier than I wanted it to be, because I wanted to program this stuff in there to get an idea about the structure of the octonions. So it was completely useless. It was a waste of my time, because what am I going to do with an octonion multiplication program? Look at her thing. All she does is things with coefficients of 1 and 0, or 1 and minus 1. So 1, minus 1, and 0. You've got those 3 coefficients. Well, you don't need a computer program for that.
If this could be developed to the point where you could actually start making predictions, experimental kind of predictions, it might be interesting. Like, if you could program like a finished version of this theory into the computer and end up with outputs that all perfectly described all the properties of the standard model particles and the lifetimes of the unstable particles and things like that, you'd really have something.
Yeah, I don't know if that would help you do that, especially because I don't really know what all of these things are, right? So I could take this equation she has for Red's strange quark and add it to the electron neutrino, and that gives me a number, right? But what does that number mean? What does that addition mean? Does that mean that at some event in space-time, or point in space-time, if you'd like, does that mean I have three electrons and one, whatever it was, strange red quark? I mean, what does it actually mean physically?
So it's like we're missing like the dimensions that you need in order to get the physical quantities like energy and angular momentum and things like that quantified.
I don't know about that because I don't understand it well enough to understand how you'd even start on your way to get there. I don't even understand it well enough to interpret what the number means, right? I'm not sure what the number means, that number in the Actonian. It looks to me she's playing on a lattice of ones and zeros, maybe ones and minus ones. Even with that, I don't even know what they mean. I certainly don't know what all the linear combinations mean. So, I mean, it would be nice to have some idea about what they actually mean in that sense.
It'll be interesting to see what she comes up with next. Maybe she'll head in a direction where she can start tying this in with, you know, physically meaningful quantities. I wish there was a whole team of people working on this, frankly, because I think it's a fascinating direction. I mean, superstring theory has, you know, how many thousands of scientists working on it? You know, if we just had maybe a dozen people dedicated to this working together, maybe they might come up with some really interesting stuff.
Okay, well, that's all I have.
All right, Jim, thanks for helping shed some light on this stuff.
Thanks for bringing it to my attention, Randy. Why don't you have a great night?
Hey, you too, and thanks everyone for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
I know.
Bye.
You have just listened to Physics Frontiers, Episode 40, The Actonians. Show notes can be found at frontiers.physicsfm.com/40. These show notes include links to the papers that we read for this podcast, links to books mentioned during the podcast, and links to related episodes of Physics Frontiers. There are also three ways you can help out this podcast. You can subscribe on Patreon, you can buy books from one of our links. I would stay away from what we've got this time, actually. The history of vector analysis, although it's kind of interesting, is extremely dry. Process and reality is really, really, really hard in a very non-mathematical kind of way. And that senior level Physics of Atoms and Molecules book is not light on the math. There are plenty all over the place on our site, if you'd like to help us out anyway. The third one is you can go to our Facebook page and message Randy and tell him how much you love the podcast. As it is, I get to see all the great things that you're saying about the podcast, and Randy gets to see hardly any of it. He just gets to hear all about your love secondhand from me. I shouldn't say stuff like that. Bye now.